please reach out to us at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or call us at 202-588-0999. Thank you for considering becoming a part of WPFW's future.
Hello, I'm David Whetstone, and you're listening to member-supported WPFW Washington.
And welcome to Committee Watch and Comment for Tuesday, September 24th. I'm Dave Rabin. It's really great to be with you. We have an important show for you today. I think later in the program, the National Ballet of Ukraine is coming to the Kennedy Center for one night only on October 8th. We'll speak with Jeremy Courtney, founder of Humanot. Let me get that right. Humanot, the organization accepting funds from the tour to be donated to the embattled citizens of Ukraine. But first, in looking at various initiatives by conservatives, right-wingers in the United States, items like book burning, attacks on institutions of higher learning, and attempts to erase mentions of race or sexuality and gender in public schools, it's important to realize these and other efforts are not new. They come out of a fascist playbook, and they're being used in countries all over the world. These are tried and true methods with a historical record, and they soften the ground for totalitarianism by dismantling notions of what constitutes a fact, along with the idea that the only truth is an official truth. And joining us to discuss this frightening movement is author and Yale University professor of philosophy, Jason Stanley. He's the author of the best-selling How Fascism Works, and just out this month, Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Jason Stanley, welcome to Community Watch and Comment. It's great to have you.
It's great to be in discussion with you, David.
Thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate it, and we would really appreciate caller 202-588-0893. We need you. We want you to chime in. Any questions you have, any comments you have, this is really important. We're talking about putting context, putting a label, if you will, on what's happening currently in our country and around the world, and we want your input. 202-588-0893. Please chime in. Dr. Jason Stanley, this is your second book on fascism. What compelled you to write it?
Well, right now we're facing a fascist social and political movement in the United States and all over the world. So we're facing an attack on democracies. Of course, our democracies. Like the United States are far from perfect. They're deeply flawed structurally and otherwise. But we're facing a time where our rights and freedoms are being rolled back. I wanted to focus on an aspect of the attack on democratic rights and freedoms that is not always highlighted, but should be. We're familiar with attacks on voting and the courts. We see how the Republicans, for example, in the United States, go on and on about a completely delusional and made-up charge of voter fraud. But we don't as much center attacks on schools and universities. That's often because moderates join those attacks, but they've been central to post-war far-right anti-democratic movements everywhere, because schools and universities, progressive education, and critical investigation into history is taken by authoritarians as an existential threat to their programs. And that's what we find in the United States today. For years, we've had these attacks on public schools, supposedly spreading critical race theory. People laughed off these attacks on public schools. But Now we see it's created an environment of fear and terror among public school teachers, among school boards. And we see these attacks on universities as well, where university professors are having their teaching restricted increasingly and their tenure threatened. So I wanted to connect the attacks on voting to the attacks on schools and universities.
Yeah, I mean, it's really important. I think it's important to put it in the fascist context. I've done a show on book banning. I've done a show recently on voter suppression, but I did not use the word fascist. It's somewhat conspiratorial. I hadn't seen it necessarily in that context, but I think it's important to realize that. I mean, George Orwell, back in 1984, is a great novel, what, late 40s? Who controls the past controls the future. Who controls the present controls the past. You know, and I think that's the kind of idea, the kind of context that you're putting a label on and speaking to.
Yes, Orwell meant all totalitarian regimes must do this. Totalitarianism is anti-freedom, and what you have to do in a totalitarian indoctrination system, in totalitarian schools, is you have to remove the history of social movements. You have to remove any history, labor history. You have to remove any history of social struggle from below that citizens have used to challenge hierarchy and represent history as just the deeds of individual great men. This is Hitler in Mein Kampf says, you know, we have lost the art of education, meaning sort of nationalist education, of representing the great men, taking the great men of the country, of great Aryan men, and representing their greatness. So people essentially think all of history is the greatness of these people. And they don't think that they, as individual citizens, have agency. I mean, it's not complicated. Obviously, we all know that China doesn't allow the teaching of Tiananmen Square, one of America's aspiring autocrats, Ron DeSantis, doesn't allow the teaching of Black Lives Matter. You also want to, in the case, the reason I'm focusing on fascism as a kind of authoritarianism rather than, say, communist authoritarianism, is that first, we don't face the threat of communist authoritarianism in the United States today. It's ludicrous. But we do face the threat of fascist authoritarianism, which represents hierarchies of race and gender as permanent and inflexible and unchallengeable. And it represents a challenge. It tries to erase perspectives that deviate from these hierarchies of race, gender, sexual preference. So LGBTQ perspectives get eliminated as obscene. Non-dominant perspectives like labor, history of labor movements, history of Black uprisings, the unification of poor whites and poor Black Americans in a labor movement, all of that is erased, and you're told the nation is an unbreaking procession of great white men from George Washington through Andrew Carnegie to the present.
Right, and surprisingly enough, great Christian men.
Right, I mean, great white Christian men. There are no.
I mean, because I mean, it's you're creating a void. What strikes me, with our current electoral situation, is that half the country, no matter who, quote unquote, wins, and that's going to be a big question, on November 5th and after November 5th, we have a certain void where people don't understand you know, the context and all of what's going on. I mean, let's go back and look at the right wing's Trump's attack on the 1619 project, the wonderful exposition by a current professor at I believe she's at Howard University about, you know, the basis 1619 is the year, you know, the first slaves were brought to we weren't the United States yet, to North America, and that is being attacked by Trump and his allies. That a critical race theory is being attacked. It leaves African Americans without a sense of agency, without a sense of history, and the void is filled by the propaganda that Trump and his allies create.
That's right. And so Nicole Hannah-Jones's 1619 Project is, I think, the first book that's been banned by name in I heard Diane Ravitch say that on radio. It's book banning is profoundly, well, I don't want to say it's un-American because it's happened throughout our history. So it's not un-American in the sense that, you know, it hasn't happened before. But the idea that you would ban Americans from reading books is profoundly against the ideals of freedom and equality. And when you look at the books that are banned, they are uniformly the books that challenge white Christian heterosexual normativity. They're books that suggest that the world hasn't always been, America has not always been the America of white Christian heterosexual men. The perspectives of many other groups that don't fit into these categories have informed American life and American history and have changed America for the better. And these are the books, these are the perspectives that were being asked to erase, just as the Nazis burned LGBTQ literature in the first mass book burning in May 1933, and burned and repeatedly burned the works of Jewish authors. So we're being told what the works of Black American Nobel Prize winner Toni Morrison are being banned. The Bluest Eye, her work, is one of the most banned books in America. Beloved, perhaps her greatest novel. Virginia had a whole election around the Beloved bill, banning the Beloved. One of America's leading writers ever. And this idea of banning the books by great writers of the national minority comes right out of the Nazis. Let's face it, they banned books by Jewish writers. You have to ask yourself, when you're taking the writers of the great writers of the national minority in America, that would be Black Americans, as was one of our main national minority, and banning them, what's happening there? You're not focusing on the works of, I'd like to see the white heterosexual men whose books are being banned on the grounds that they're dangerous for our children, compared to, if you look at the list of banned books, it's entirely composed or virtually entirely composed by non-dominant perspectives. And that's because the goal in fascist politics is to tell young children, and indeed the whole nation, that the only legitimate perspective is the dominant perspective.
Right. Right. I should say, I'm speaking with Dr. Stanley, Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University, author of numerous books, including most recently Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. And we would love to hear from folks. Please, we need your voices to chime in. Comments, questions, 202-588-0893, that's 202-588-0893. This is Community Watch and Comment, and we need your comments, so please chime in. One of the big things I've emphasized repeatedly on this program over the years is the whole idea that I think is not spoken enough about redlining. You know, and this came out of a Democratic administration, Franklin Roosevelt. But the problem is that the Democratic administration of Roosevelt was Southern-based, and it was racist. Not that Roosevelt was racist, but he was, you know, having to work within the parameters of a racist party. And you've got redlining where African-Americans and other minorities are not able to get mortgages. I mean, very explicitly, this is not some conspiratorial idea, very explicitly. And, you know, 30 years ago, I had virtually no wealth. I had my cello and that's about it, you know? And now I'm technically, you know, a wealthy person, you know, and it's because of home ownership. I mean, imagine if I hadn't been able to get a mortgage, and African-Americans under the Roosevelt administration couldn't do it. And that kind of history is eliminated under the kinds of book banning and erasing of history that the right wing, that Trump and his allies want. If you could talk about that. It's really quite outrageous.
So redlining is a perfect example of the perfidy of what is now occurring. Critical race theory is the study of structures that perpetuate racial hierarchy. In other words, how certain practices in banking, in policing, in education, keep Black Americans poorer than white Americans with less wealth. And also dominated culturally in other ways. So redlining is a perfect example. Redlining is it shows that, you know, Black Americans were denied housing loans, so they couldn't purchase houses, and so they couldn't pass generational wealth. That explains why most Black Americans don't have generational wealth, because they couldn't inherit houses from their families. So that preserves the extremely large racial wealth gap in America. So it's not explicit racism per se that explains why the average Black family has only a fraction of the wealth. We're not talking about income, we're talking about wealth of the average white family. That's because so much of our wealth, the ordinary American family's wealth, comes from the house that they owned and its increase in value. Now, critical race theory studies things like redlining. It tells you, this is what I just gave you was a critical, you know, would be a class in a course that covered critical race theory. However, that's illegal to teach in more than 20 states and increasingly illegal to teach even in universities. So the very knowledge that you gave to me and that you shared with your listeners is illegal to teach, not just in schools, but in universities. The University of Tennessee has the state of Tennessee is an online reporting form for reporting any professor who teaches anything that might make white students feel uncomfortable because of their race. Now, of course, being told that your family's inherited wealth has a large component that is due to your race, the paradigm example of something that will make you feel shame about your race, and so is illegal to teach. So many schools and now universities, this basic fact and other similar basic facts about American life are illegal to teach and might lead to suspension, the loss of your job, or other civil penalties.
I mean, you're not exaggerating this. I mean, it's extraordinary. The University of Tennessee,
The state of Tennessee.
Okay, you actually can be dismissed. You can lose tenure at these universities if you teach about redlining. I mean, it's extraordinarily frightening.
It's the most extreme attack on American universities in American history. I believe the McCarthy era will be a drop in the bucket compared to what we're seeing today and what we're increasingly seeing with the protests on campus last year, the anti-war protests on campus, using to justify even more of this kind of crackdown.
Right, we're talking about protests against the U.S. support for the war against the Palestinians in Gaza.
Exactly.
And the Israeli action involved. I should say we have a caller, which is really terrific. Thank you so much for chiming in, your question, your comment, your name, and where you're calling from, if you like. And I really appreciate you checking in. I hear you not. Are you with us, caller?
Excuse me?
Are you with us? So we'd love to hear your thoughts, your questions.
My name is David Allen, and I got a question to your panel. Do you have any information on quick claim deeds? And the reason I asked the question is because if the mayor of the city can sign off on a quick claim deed denouncing you of your ownership in the projects. See, the projects should have been given to, now this is a method, my method. If you give the rights of the people the right to own their home, now that's a program, a project program. But the idea is to let you have ownership of that property. That'll free the government up with an expense that they have to take care of it. If you got your own, if they give you the right to it and you become the homeowner of that project, then you'll be liable or held responsible for taking care of that property. Incentive. And it also helps the government with a piece of money. But why does the mayor have the right to sign that quick claim deed denouncing your ownership because it's a project? I need an answer.
Great. I appreciate you calling in, Dr. Stanley. Any thoughts on the quick claim deed?
I it's the really outside of my area of expertise.
Yeah. Mine as well. I appreciate it. I'm sorry we don't have an answer for you. Thank you for calling regardless. I think we have a couple of other callers. This is really terrific. Next caller, your question or your comment, your name if you like, and where you're calling from.
Hi, my name is Tom. I'm calling from Alexandria. And regarding the censorship issue, I think there are some Supreme Court decisions speaking of a right to hear or a right to listen. And can the censorship laws of some states, you know, banning books on certain topics, be challenged under the First Amendment as violating a right to listen or hear? And is have any of them been, and are there any cases that raise that issue?
Good.
Thanks so much for calling.
Yes, very, very good. I mean, this is of course the way to challenge these. So the Classroom Censorship Act, the sort of first big Classroom Censorship Act, by Ron DeSantis, the Stop Woke Act, was blocked by an appeals court, and a large amount of it was, in fact, successfully overturned. However, the Trump court, the Supreme Court, is a Trump court. And so I think there's little reason to think there are going to be any kind of, I think the problem is once these laws are being challenged, the Stop Woke Act, as I said, was blocked and then severely curtailed. But I'm not sure what the ultimate fate of these laws will be when they meet a Supreme Court that's you know, a rubber stamp for the far right. So we will see. There was success in the case of the Stop Woke Act, but the methods you know, we're, it's an ongoing process, and yes, you are absolutely right that the way to challenge it is in the courts, but it's going to take years. And the problem is that the courts are being have been and will be taken over by.
I mean, it's something that I think is not being addressed enough in the current electoral season. Though, what happens in the next 4 years in terms of you know, Supreme Court and other judicial appointments, you know, there very well could be at least one on the Supreme Court. And it's terribly important who gets to nominate those judicial appointments, you know, for this kind of issue and all kinds of issues. I mean, there's been some very, very extremely serious issues dealt with, particularly in the last year by the U.S. Supreme Court. And
well, now
it's really important.
Now we see with this, we see like the attacks on the, you know, the attacks on universities, preventing professors from teaching basic facts about American history because it might make white students feel badly. We're not talking about elementary school. We're talking about professors. We're talking about bills in Indiana and Ohio, two of states with two of the greatest public universities in the world, that that say that professors are going to face post-tenure review to see if they have intellectual diversity and different in their classrooms. Essentially, that gives an ideological cudgel to remove people's tenure, to fire professors if they, you know, don't agree with the if they're sort of ideologically deviant from the far right nationalist consensus. Florida has restricted its professors from criticizing the governor in some move that's like right out of, you know, a dystopian novel about totalitarianism. So the courts are going to be very important here. And so, you know, you can be sure that if there's another 4 years of Trump, you know, our freedoms, the freedom. I mean, my view is that a far right professor should be allowed to teach in a university if they have the, not just should be allowed to teach, but should be allowed to teach their views, whatever, you know, if they have the qualifications and their discipline that got them that job. That we're not going to see those freedoms remain because we're going to see things like critique of politicians in the classroom, in university classrooms, made illegal. Now, the effects on K through 12 education are, of course, the most serious. Encouraging families and students to turn in their own teachers for non-ideological conformity. That's what we have right now. In an authoritarian society, you're trying to train people to turn in their fellow citizens. And that's what these laws encourage.
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely serious. We have a couple of callers, but I just want to get a little further into the weeds here. So you've got the situation where you attack education, you attack people potentially critical of government, including tenured professors. This is, you know, you work hard. I'm assuming, Dr. Stanley, that you are tenured. You know, it's not an easy slog to get there, and you have a certain level of security when you get tenureship, and that is attacked. It makes people frightened. It makes the educational community understandably frightened. You create a certain kind of void, and that is the entree to authoritarianism. And you know, you've got a Mr. Trump saying back in the day, and I think he would say it again, you know, only I can fix it, you know. And then you then you have an opportunity to say, you know, immigrants, Haitian immigrants are eating our dogs, they're eating our cats. And, you know, even if Trump loses the election, which is going to take a long time after November 5th to determine, you know, you've got half the country supporting him, and it's nurtured by the void created by this attack on education. I've spoken enough. If you could talk about that.
Yeah. Just a quick note on tenure. The United States has the world's greatest university system. Everyone in the world sends their kids to our universities. We are willingly dismantling that university system. We are attacking that. I mean, do people don't want to send their kids to universities in China? Not because the physics isn't excellent. It is, but because you're not allowed to say what you want. There are no liberal arts colleges in authoritarian countries. That doesn't exist, because a liberal arts college is a place where you can speak your mind, you can experiment with different viewpoints, and without legal repercussions. So you can argue for different positions. Sure, you know, you might become unpopular, but a liberal arts college, you need to think about the fact. Why aren't there liberal arts colleges in authoritarian countries? Why is there no New College of Florida, Wesleyan University, Amherst College? They don't exist in authoritarian countries. Now, you can see what DeSantis in Florida has done to New College of Florida. He's destroyed it completely. It was an elite public liberal arts college in the state of Florida, and he targeted it. I think a third of the faculty have left, and a lot of Florida's faculty members are trying to leave. So he has radically increased the, you know, athletic scholarships, and there's talk of a major in electronic games and things like this. So I think that's right. But you know, the curriculum has been destroyed. He's essentially taken a wrecking ball to it. This is what we are willingly doing to the greatest university system in the world. One of the main reasons we have the greatest university system in the world is we make the widest use of tenure protections. Now, people might think, okay, tenure, that's such a luxury, you don't have to be fired. Well, to be a professor, you go to college, then you spend 5 to 12 years in graduate school, and then you try to get an almost impossibly difficult, you try to do something almost impossibly difficult, trying to get a position as a professor. There are vanishingly small, few positions, and you've trained 5 to 12 years after college to get one. Once you get one, you are paid, maybe your starting salary is $60,000 a year. Maybe if you're lucky, you'll retire at $110,000 a year. Why the hell would anyone spend until they're 32 or 33 or 35 in college to apply to a position where you're competing with massive competition for a middle-class salary? That's because there's tenure and academic freedom. Once you eliminate the protection of tenure, why would people do this? It would be foolish to, there'd be no reason at all. The only reason that people take relatively low paying jobs for which they've worked so long to get and are lucky to get, and there's no choice about where you live. If you get a job in, Nebraska, you go to Nebraska because, you know, you hit the jackpot, you got an academic position. Why would anyone go through that if there were no tenure? And that's what they're doing. And that's the destruction of our university system. And then we know just by looking at the world, when you destroy freedom, freedom of inquiry, when you prevent people, when you pass laws that say people can't teach basic history, what results is a university system that is just simply something of a joke.
It's extremely insidious. It's not on enough people's radar, and it's extraordinarily important in the long run. We have another caller, so appreciate you chiming in, calling in your question, your comment. Your name, if you like, where you're calling from. Appreciate you checking in.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. My name is Robert A. Moses. I'm calling from Fort Washington, Maryland.
Great.
I like to say that it sounds like, I'm not sure if I'm having a misunderstanding or not, but I'm going to say that, you know, the fascist forces have taken over in Ukraine, and NATO is supporting the fascist forces, and so what we have is a proxy war between the ex-Soviet Union, and based upon Cold War issues, and NATO should have been disbanded when the Soviet Union was disbanded, and this fascism is trying to surround China, and we've got to get beyond this Cold War enemy mentality, and I think.
Okay.
Thank you for checking in, Dr. Stanley.
I teach in Ukraine. I've accepted a permanent position at the Kyiv School of Economics. I'm there several times a year. I'm going again in December. I just
wow, fantastic.
From Ukraine. My salary goes to the Ukrainian Armed Forces via the Come Back Alive Foundation. With all due respect, the claim that fascists have taken over in Ukraine is absurd. Ukrainian people are as Democrat. They can't stand politicians. They want to rush the bum out. It's a very democratic culture. It's, you know, you're allowed to say whatever you want. They're under attack from a leader, from Vladimir Putin, who poisons Russian dissidents with radiation in other countries, who poisoned my friend Elena Kostyuchenko, the journalist who dared to challenge him, who kills massive numbers of opposition journalists, who murders opposition politicians, who has made LGBTQ perspectives illegal, thereby, creating a model for folks like Ron DeSantis here, and indeed has made it illegal to be gay or lesbian. Listen to Vladimir Putin's justification for the full-scale invasion of Ukraine. Vladimir Putin, on the eve of the Ukraine invasion, said, "We are going to war to prevent the ideology of parent one and parent two." In other words, one of Putin's central reasons for invading Ukraine is same-sex relationships. He wants to make sure that there are no same-sex relationships in Eastern Europe. Who's the fascist here?
Yeah, I mean it relates back to former President Trump, maybe future President Trump, who, according to a previous wife, his bedside reading was speeches by Hitler. You've probably heard about this, Dr. Stanley. I mean, and this is not a well-read man, you know. I think you talk about his attack on Haitian immigrants in Springfield, Ohio, you know, and Haitians are from a country with the only successful slave rebellion in the history of the planet. You know, I doubt very much that Donald Trump knows about that. He's not a well-read man, but one, you know, and I guess the guy that wrote his Art of the Deal said that he saw no books in the guys in Trump's lodging. But according to a former wife, the speeches of Hitler were by his bedside. If you could just talk about that. I mean, it's extremely insidious. I mean, I'm reluctant to use the word fascism applied to this country, but it's more and more appropriate, I think.
The Ku Klux Klan was the first functionally fascist organization. The second Klan in the 1920s was a fascist, was indistinguishable from the Nazis. Black American intellectuals from Du Bois and Langston Hughes on have called Jim Crow fascist. Langston Hughes said in 1937, Black Americans don't need to be told what fascism is. It's just a European word for Jim Crow. Hitler, the Nazi Nuremberg laws were based on the Jim Crow laws. The lawyers studied the Jim Crow laws. The United States, interracial marriage was not fully legal until 1967, 2 years before my birth. this was a racist pariah country. And it's the one that Hitler in Mein Kampf says he admires more than any other. He says he wants to build a country that is built on a legacy of genocide, like our indigenous genocide and slavery. So Hitler very explicitly in Mein Kampf singles out the United States as a country he wants to model. We fought Hitler and fascism with a segregated army. So it's very clear that there is a long history of racial fascism in the United States, but there is also a long history of combating racial fascism in the United States, combating it, pushing it back, opening the door a bit further and further for democratic rights and freedoms and equality. And what we're seeing now is we're seeing that door being slowly pushed shut again.
Yeah. We, unfortunately, are going to have to end it there. I think I got through about one quarter of my questions for you. We're going to have you back. It's such an important book. I've been speaking with Dr. Jason Stanley of Yale University, author of numerous books, including most recently, Erasing History, How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Thank you for all you're doing. Thank you for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, David.
All right. It's great having you. Take care. And on to our next and last guest, an important guest, I believe, the National Ballet of Ukraine is coming to the Kennedy Center for one night only, October 8th. Jeremy Courtney, founder of Human Night, I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, the organization accepting funds from the tour to be donated to the embattled citizens of Ukraine. Mr. Courtney joins us now. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, David, good to be with you.
You know, it's really kind of extraordinary. We were just with Dr. Stanley, you might have heard it, you know, talking about the situation in Ukraine. I should say, in the interest of full disclosure, both my grandmothers were born there, as was, you know, an enormous number of Russian notables. I think Trotsky was born in Ukraine. I think Prokofiev, the great composer, was born in Ukraine. I mean, a fountainhead of culture and politics, very, very important. But it's under siege, needless to say, and it's kind of extraordinary that the arts are continuing to soldier on, if you will, in Ukraine, as evidenced by this tour of the whole country, and I think previously of Canada, by the National Ballet of Ukraine.
Yeah, that's right. You mentioned Ukraine being a fountainhead of arts and culture, and that's a lot of what we're hoping to put on display here with this tour that Humanite has helped arrange in bringing the National Ballet of Ukraine to North America. We previously toured Canada, which went off extremely well. You know, one of the things that we knew, Humanite has been at the forefront of these conflicts for nearly 20 years as a team across Iraq, Syria, you know, the broader Middle East, Afghanistan. And so when we saw this war escalating and reaching its peak in 2022, you know, though there was a lot of support obviously that flowed toward Ukraine at that time, we knew, unfortunately, from our front row seat to these other conflicts, that it likely wouldn't last for long. You know, you can't sustain global attention and empathy, unfortunately, simply by continuing to recite that Russia has bombed a new school, a new hospital, a new opera house, you know, today. And so we wanted to start putting something in place that would allow us to keep the conversation going about Ukraine long after global interest started to wane. And here we are today. You know, we're nearly 3 years into this thing in our third year. And, you know, Ukraine doesn't occupy a point of concern for most people the way it did a couple of years ago. And we understand that. You can't just continue to talk about suffering every day. People numb out. And But we wanted to find a common ground. We wanted to tap into that fountainhead of culture that many of us are kind of at least broadly aware of, and find a common ground that we could all meet on, art, culture, literature, beauty, elegance, dignity, and say, this is what's at stake here. This is something we all enjoy. This is something we can all agree on is worth preserving. And what would it be like if this dance, if this talent, if this caliber of excellence were wiped off the face of the earth altogether?
Yeah, I mean, it's an extraordinary effort. If you could just touch on your organization. So you're an organization that has dealt with support for various countries under siege. Forgive me, I'm not sufficiently up on your organization. If you could talk about that, it sounds like a wonderful undertaking. You've been around for 20 years.
Yeah, so Humanite Peace Collective, humanite.org, is founded by a group of refugees and war survivors. We've been living on the front lines of these wars across Iraq, Syria, Israel, Palestine for nearly the last 20 years. My colleagues, my coworkers, my co-founders, we've come up through these wars and that have dominated global headlines, you know, for most of our adult lives. And so we know what it's like to be displaced as a team. Our team, my teammates, my colleagues know what it's like to be shot at on the front lines, know what it's like to be hit by airstrikes, genocide survivors. And I think that places our team in a unique position to look at some of these things differently than some of the big aid groups that come in from the outside and bring in foreign solutions to what are, you know, very local, acute community realities. And with that in mind, we knew that we would need to engage Ukraine, or at least we had an opportunity to engage the Ukrainian situation a little bit differently based on the track record that we've been living through, you know, in Iraq, Syria, Gaza, and beyond.
Yeah.
We primarily focus on helping people get their lives back before, during, and after war. We work on peace. We work to bring people together before, during, and after war, whether that means providing emergency food, water, shelter, or long-term job creation and economic development. We try to do it all through a lens of peace building, working across enemy lines, working across lines of division, bringing people back to the table to find common ground.
Wonderful. We were a little short on time. We have about 6 minutes. Talk about the challenges that the dancers of the Ukraine ballet face living and working in a war zone. I mean, it's kind of unimaginable, but if you could talk about that.
It is. I think about our friends Tatiana and Yaroslav. I was just with them in Kyiv a couple months ago, and the challenges they face shuttling back and forth between home and the ballet where they perform a couple nights a week. World-class dancers, world-class artists who are excited to come to DC and perform in the United States at, you know, our premier National Arts Center for the first time. But when they're back home in Kyiv, you know, they'll do a performance at the Opera House in Kyiv and then head home for the night. And if airstrikes have sounded or the siren is going off, electricity is out in their building, you know, due to the war, they live 17 stories up. So you can imagine after a long night of dancing and working hard and leaping through the air to entertain audiences and try and help them just escape the daily realities for a few hours every night. Now, Tatiana, Yaroslav are facing 17 flights of stairs to climb up and reach their kids, only to get to the top of the stairs and, you know, have another bomb siren go off, air raid siren go off, gather their kids, and then rush back down 17 flights of stairs into the basement where they're hiding from Russian airstrikes. I mean, this is kind of a daily reality that everyone's still living through. But when they show up on stage, whether it's in Kyiv or whether it's at the Kennedy Center, they are ambassadors of beauty, ambassadors of their art and their culture and their country, and trying to help people find that higher plane. You know, when they're in Kyiv, they're trying, trying to help their fellow citizens just have a taste of normalcy. just escape. And I can tell you from sitting in the opera house in Kyiv, I'm no deep aficionado of the ballet, but when you sit and watch these world-class performers, you get engrossed into the worlds that they create, and the worlds that they create are worlds of fun and beauty and love stories. And that's at the heart of it, what Ukraine is trying to just preserve. They're trying to preserve the right to still go about their lives in all of its intricacies and pursue their romantic relationships and all the things that, you know, these historic ballets kind of put to stage. And that's what's under threat. It's just daily life, daily realities, the normal things that we all get to take for granted here in the United States so much.
Yeah. We should say that this is not only about putting forth the culture, the art of Ukraine, but it's also about raising money.
Yes. Every night we'll be raising.
There's obvious expenses with the tour and such, and keeping food in the mouth of the performers. But you know, this is also an enterprise that's raising money for certain particularly oppressed, challenged people in Ukraine. If you could just touch on that.
Yeah, tickets are available at nationalukraineballet.com. And those ticket costs go to cover the cost of the tour and the production. But once we're on stage every night and during the performance, there will be an opportunity for patrons and audiences to give additionally to help us provide bomb shelters and underground classrooms to the nearly 1 million Ukrainian children who have been displaced from their schools and are still unable to study in person with their peers and their teachers. So nationalukraineballet.com is where you can get tickets to the Kennedy Center show, nationalukraineballet.com. And Humanite Peace Collective will be raising money every night to make sure that we can build as many bomb shelters and classrooms as possible in the coming year.
And accompanying the classical ballet on the tours is folk dancers. It sounds just terrific. What a wonderful combination. I don't think I've been to a ballet performance, you know, that included, you know, indigenous folk dancers. It just sounds like quite an evening.
Yeah, it's really something fun. We end on a very high note with the folk dancers. Shumka will be integrated throughout, certainly, but ending on a very high note with the Hopak traditional Ukrainian dance that gets audiences, you know, on their feet, cheering and really feeling like there's a future here. There's a future, there's a hope, there's an excitement and an energy that is worth our continued friendship and partnership with the people of Ukraine.
And where can people get more information about the performance? Just one night at the Kennedy Center here in D.C., you could talk about where people could get more information about that.
Yeah, that's right. NationalUkraineBallet.com is where you can get tickets to the Kennedy Center show on October 8th. NationalUkraineBallet.com for October 8th at the Kennedy Center. Donations can be made ahead of time at humanite.org to help us accelerate our efforts to provide bomb shelters and underground classrooms to Ukrainian children. Humanite.org, NationalUkraineBallet.com.
I've been joined by someone that's very associated with this tour of the Ukrainian ballet, the National Ballet of Ukraine. Not a dancer himself, but looked like it could be, but someone intimately familiar with the ballet company, Jeremy Courtney from Humanite. Thank you very, very much for all you're doing and for joining us today.
Thank you, David, for your time. Appreciate it.
Really appreciate it. And that's going to do it for our show. I want to alert people to a celebration on September 28th, a celebration reflections on the campaign victory of Julian Assange. It's from 5 to 7. And Andy Shalal's Bus Boys and Poets, the one at 14th and V, it should be quite an evening. Medea Benjamin and others, John Curia Cow and others will be speaking It's going to be quite an evening, September 28th, 5 to 7, Plus Boards and Poets, 14th and B. Julian is free, but, you know, there's all sorts of reflections and understanding needed to further the cause, if you will. So do check that out. And that is going to do it for our show. And I want to thank the amazing Mike Masella for his engineering expertise and pulling us through the program. Coming up, the WPFW FM news headlines, followed by Lady Murr with Don't Forget the Blues. Thank you so much for listening. We really appreciate it. I'm Dave Rabin. Have a great week.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Christina Onnested. Israel and Hezbollah are trading strikes again as the death toll from a massive Israeli bombardment in Lebanon has climbed to more than 560 people, including 50 children and more than 1,800 others wounded. The United Nations Children Agency, UNICEF, says more children are likely dead under the rubble. Ravina Shamdasasi, a spokesperson for the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, is calling for an end to the violence.
Call on all parties to immediately cease the violence and to ensure the protection of civilians. One of our UN human rights colleagues in Beirut lost 7 of her family members yesterday, including 2 children aged 8 and 1, in an Israeli airstrike in South Lebanon. Roads in southern Lebanon are crammed with people in cars fleeing the violence. International humanitarian law is very clear. All parties to an armed conflict must at all times distinguish between the civilian population and combatants.
Thousands of people have fled from southern Lebanon, with the two sides on the brink of all-out war. The U.S. is urging Americans in Lebanon to leave as it's sending more troops to the Middle East in response to the sharp spike in violence between Israel and Hezbollah. The Pentagon declined to say what additional resources it's sending. There's about 40,000 U.S. troops in the region already. Activists are planning a national day of action against the war in Gaza and Lebanon in major U.S. cities today, including at the nation's capital, New York City, Houston, Seattle, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. Actions are also planned in Canada, in Toronto, and Ottawa. World leaders are gathered for the United Nations General Assembly in New York under the shadow of major wars in Gaza, Ukraine, and Sudan, and the threat of an even larger conflict in the Middle East. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres opened the meeting today, slamming nations that he says act with impunity in these wars.
They can thumb their nose at international humanitarian law. They can invade another country, lay waste to whole societies, or utterly disregard the welfare of their own people, and nothing will happen. Gaza is a non-stop nightmare that threatens to take the entire region with it. Look no further than Lebanon. We should all be alarmed by the escalation. Lebanon is at the brink. The people of Lebanon, the people of Israel, and the people of the world cannot afford Lebanon to become another Gaza.
U.S. President Joe Biden will also address the United Nations Assembly today. It will be his final address as U.S. president before the U.N. Climate activists are gathering in New York for Climate Week. More than 30 people were arrested at a protest outside the headquarters of investment bank Citigroup Monday. Protesters had been demanding a meeting with city executives to discuss what they say are the company's racist financing of dirty energy projects. The protest was in part a response to a newly released report linking premature deaths in communities of color to air pollution produced by projects funded by Citigroup. Hanna Sago is a senior climate finance campaigner with Stand.Earth and a lead author of the report, City, Funding Fossil-Fueled Environmental Racism in the Gulf South.
We found that by providing at least $1.6 billion in financing for 4 LNG export terminals in Texas and Louisiana, City could be associated with up to $36 million in health costs per year, 2 premature deaths per year, and 10 new childhood asthma cases every year. And if those LNG export terminals operate for an expected lifespan of 35 years and those deaths stay constant, city could be attributed with as many as 80 premature deaths from the air pollution of the facilities it's financed.
California is suing oil giant ExxonMobil in the first of its kind lawsuit, alleging it engaged in a decades-long campaign to deceive the public about plastics, claiming they can be recycled while knowing they